My name's Chris Scott, and you're listening to a podcast from the UK Wine Show. The UK Wine Show is brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company in Australia and the UK. Have a good listen. Hi, I'm here with Gregory Dieb from Crown Wine Cellars. How are you guys?
Very, very good. Thanks, Chris. Good to speak to you.
We're going to be talking today a wee bit about your business.
Yeah.
And a wee bit more about where you think your customers are and where you think your business is going to be going in the future.
Sure, Chris.
Let's start off with your business. We touched on a wee bit earlier about you've got a number of sites around Hong Kong and on the north. They call them new territories, don't they?
New territories, mainland peninsula, but still Hong Kong territory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was after the Second Opium War or something like that, or...
Yeah, that's getting into a very detailed history conversation.
We
move back to wine.
Why did you put facilities on the new territories? Was it to be close to China, or what was the reason for that?
Actually, a number of reasons. The first one is the mother company that I gained my financial support from owned a couple of buildings in the new territories, and some of our facilities are actually located inside their buildings for continuity. The way we do our wine cellaring is we have a massive investment cost in structures because it's the only way that we can actually ensure the climatic condition results that we deem necessary. So with that massive cash injection, you really do want to own the building because if there's any problems with leasehold or otherwise, the losses could be substantial. That's point number one. Point number two is due to my former career, I have a very close relationship with Hong Kong government. One of the requests that they would make to organizations is perhaps to set up in areas where there's underemployment to assist the local economy of that area. Also to be conservation friendly, environmentally friendly, to stop people having to travel great distances to get to the office, rather take the office and put it where the people are. So part of our intention is to go to this area called Tuen Mun, which is suffering some underemployment at the moment. And when I set up, certainly the economy wasn't great in those areas. And that way government's happy, we're happy, environmentalists are happy. And finally, they're very close to the ports and airport. And ironically, they're not that far away from the border. They're on a ring road that runs up to the border. So it makes my mainland clients very happy. It's no disadvantage for my local Hong Kong clients. And certainly from a logistics point of view, it's very efficient.
Do you have many mainland clients?
We actually...
And is that what you call
Chinese?
We do. Yeah. They're called mainlanders.
Actually, ironically, we call ourselves Chinese, and we speak Chinese, even though it's Cantonese is the correct term. And we would regard Putonghua as Mandarin, and that's the language of the mainland people, which is up north. So it's very interesting. When I first arrived in Asia many years ago, my Hong Kong friends and colleagues would say, you know, yes, I speak Chinese. And I said, oh, yes, so you do speak Mandarin or you speak Putonghua. And they'd look at me in horror and say, no, I speak Cantonese. You know, that's Chinese. But yeah, the chaps across the border do speak Putonghua. So there is this distinction. We regard ourselves as Hong Kongers or Chinese, and they would be mainlanders.
Because you're actually South African.
I was born in South Africa.
And you still do. You do have a slight South African
you
twang.
You will never, ever lose it. I think it's a little bit like being an Australian or a New Zealander. But Hong Kong has been my home for a very long time. And my children were born here. I always tell people my only properties are in Hong Kong as well. So, and my kids actually go to a local Chinese school. So their education is 100% in Cantonese. So this is home. This is where I belong. This is where I'll probably pass on one day.
What sort of breakdown have you got between, say, mainland Chinese versus Hong Kong Chinese versus Europeans versus whatever grouping you've got there?
Right now, I'll start off by saying my mainland clients are the biggest growth area. There are tremendous growth in mainland wine collectors. Many people accuse them of only being wine consumers, but that's not true. All the wines going into the mainland, because the
there's
tax
nothing
is
wrong
very
with
high.
Consumers.
Absolutely, it's very healthy for a market.
I think they're the most important people.
Not going to argue there. It creates a good flow of wines, But no, these chaps tend to take in what they'd like to drink, and the rest of their collections tend to remain in Hong Kong.
Because you're
for tax
free here.
Absolutely.
And what's the tax in the mainland?
It's an accumulative tax, and it works out to only about 48%.
48?
Yeah, that's regarded as very low, because in the old days, Hong Kong used to have 80, then 100, then back to 80, and then down to 40, and then to zero. So 48 is actually not that punitive. But there's this weird law in China that permits their agriculture and fisheries, their quarantines chaps, to remove up to 3 bottles of every vintage, of every varietal, of every different estate that goes in. And that's not just a once-off. It can happen with every import into the country. So if you have 100,000 bottles of Lao Li Bei, they actually tested to see whether they match the label.
Destructive and testing through the
believe it or not, they're not the only country that does this. It's pretty weird. I believe Brazil's another one, and there's a number of other places. So it's not out of sync with the rest of the world, but it can play havoc if you're a fine wine collector and you only have 6 bottles of 82 Patrice that are going in. You know, to lose 3 of them could be quite dramatic. As I say, if you have 100,000 bottles of Cloudy Bay, losing 3 is not that tragic. So commercial wines are not impacted too badly. But rare and fine wines, it just is another reason why Hong Kong is growing. So on the spread, we have about 25% local Chinese, 25% local foreigner, which would be a chap like myself, 25% foreigners, and that could be Koreans, Japanese, British, or otherwise.
They're just non-domiciled or non-permanent
non-domiciled resident. And non-Chinese. And then the last category where our mainland collectors would fit in is 25% foreign Chinese. And they could be from Indonesia, mainland, they could be from the UK. But they typically don't fit into the foreigner category.
Is that by volume or by value? Is there a breakdown?
Actually, pretty much on both. It's quite remarkable how the foreign Chinese and the foreigners have caught up to the local Chinese and the local foreigners. The group that is growing fastest, though, has to be the foreign Chinese. The local foreigners and the local Chinese currently own around 20% of all the rare and fine wines in the world. And there are only 7 million of us, so that's a pretty amazing per capita number of wines. And that's been around for the last 30, 40 years. It's not something that's just happened yesterday.
What's driving that? Are they buy them to drink, or that do they see them as an investment? Or
I think both. I would say that group is probably the most prolific group of wine drinkers in the world I've ever come across, and that really is.
And you're from South Africa,
and I'm from South Africa. So you know, if I was from Moscow, that would be the only way I could overstate that statistic any more highly. We are pretty wealthy in this area of the world, and the wealthy community within Hong Kong has a very low tax rate. They're incredibly successful business people, and they carry a lot of disposable income around. So whether it's Rolls-Royce and Bentley, whether it's Patek Philippe watches, or whether it's great investment wines, if you have a look at the greatest number per capita in the world, Hong Kong actually has a number of these records, whether it be Ferraris or Patek Philippe watches, or Lafitte wine. So this is something that over the last 40 years we've taken an interest in. We tended to keep the wines in the UK and Europe, but also in the US and in some instances as far as Australia and Singapore. But now more recently, it's coming home, and it's coming home pretty quickly.
Is there particular wines that are popular? You know, is
absolutely.
It everything's just first growth, give me first growth, or is there a particular brand?
You've hit it on the button right away. Bordeaux first growths is by far the most important category of four collections. I would say Burgundy's come in as a good second. And then you start throwing in your Californian greats, your Australian collectibles, a few ragtag wines from places like Spain, like Vega Sicilia. But they're very distinct estates. I mean, it is left and right bank. It's Petrus, it's Lafitte, it's Latour, it's Aubryon, Mouton. California, it's Ridge, it's Chateau Montelena, Arugia. And then obviously Australia, Grange, Jim Barry, Henschke, those are the greats from there. There's a couple from the New World that are catching up, like Vergeliergen from Africa. You know, there's a few others, I gather, from Douro province. Certainly some of the great ports will always be great ports. So they are a couple of flashpoints here and there. Champagnes from the UK. Very interestingly, a couple of the champagne collectors are busy putting together. So
sparkling wines from the UK.
Absolutely. Well,
not champagne from the UK.
You know, I'm a traditionalist on this one. I say ports from South Africa, champagnes from the UK. And, when somebody's been producing something for 350 years, I think this latest round of it's ours and nobody else's can be a little silly sometimes. So
English sparkling wine?
English sparkling wine, absolutely. I was really hoping you wouldn't focus on this and ask me the name, but we actually had it about 3 or 4 months ago at a fairly high-end dinner here, and it was the champagne of choice on the evening, alongside Paul Rouget from the 60s, alongside some really great 82s. There was 61 Cheval. And this brilliant sparkling from...
Was it Nightimber or Ridgeview?
Nightimber was certainly one of the sparklings that were served. And it is brilliant. But there is another little estate and...
Ridgeview.
Damn, I really wish I could remember the name. I should know this, and certainly before I interview as well. But Nightimber is really well acknowledged as well, I can tell you now.
Ridgeview is generally considered the best out of the best. UK.
It could very well have been. Ridgeview's lovely. But you also have Schramsberg from the US, for example, and that's the champagne that Nixon, in those days it was champagne, that Nixon served to Mao Zedong in 72. So it's got an impeccable history. It's served at the White House all the time. And it's as about champagne as you can possibly get.
So except for not coming from champagne.
For not carrying the label. Although I do believe the US held out longer than any other country issue. And I was hoping they'd stick with it until the end. But so be it. So anyway, refocusing again, the great French wines, absolutely. They're the great collectibles. But they also happen to be the great auction wines and the great investment wines in the world. So I don't think that's any different from any other place. But there is a broader-based drinking culture out there that goes a lot wider.
You're saying that the mainland markets, they're into their first growths and all that.
Certainly.
Sort of thing. But getting to more common everyday gluggers.
Yes.
Not necessarily gluggers, but because I popped into a dairy or a corner shop and I saw Yellowtail on sale for the equivalent of about £10.
Yes.
And I was just, Yellowtail's, you can drink it, it's okay wine, but... 10 quid a bottle is a bit great. 100 Hong Kong dollars.
You're on the button here, Chris. I think, our logistics and our storage, as I mentioned earlier, really, really are top end. We don't really have a bottom end logistics supplier here. So when you're speaking about a wine that costs £1,000 per bottle, that logistics component is not really much of a big deal.
Yeah.
But when you're talking about, a $1 a bottle, a 50p bottle, it's going to add another 50p to it. So this is where the Yellowtail suddenly jumps from £4 to £8. It's one of those things we just have to live with here. And fortunately, the zero tax means that we're having a lot more great wines coming in just above the Yellowtail. And actually not that pricey, because that £4 of logistics hassle and storage hassle and high salaries that we pay in Hong Kong and very high rentals that we have to pay for retail outlets here, that £4, when it suddenly gets added to a £20 wine, is not that much. When it gets added to a £200 wine, it's really not that much, and so we carry on. So perhaps what we'll see is a couple of the Yellowtails disappearing eventually. And those brilliant £20 wines that we spoke about earlier, they will become, the daily drinkers of people locally. And that would be your Killer Canoons and your Mosswoods. And we mentioned earlier Astrolabe. These are incredible wines. And you can get them as well at around about £12, £15. So,
what is the general public drinking? What style of wines?
It's Australian. We are actually following the UK quite closely, in the sense that on a volume basis, Australia will probably overtake France pretty soon, and I think it has already in the UK a good 1 or 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Value, it's not going to come close for quite a long time.
South Africa just took over France and
my
UK.
My goodness, that is unreal.
France is in third place now.
Well, I must say South Africa here, because the
weak rand.
Now, even the weak rand hasn't really helped it in Hong Kong very much. South Africa, unfortunately, unjustifiably, is around about 2% of the local market. So we're still very much Australia, Chile, and New Zealand-centric at the moment. Mainland market, I believe, is adopting a very, very nice Australia, Chile, New Zealand type of taste as well. And there's a reason for this. Only about 7 to 10% of all the bottled wine sold in China are imported into China. 90% are locally produced. Of the 90% that are locally produced in China, quite a large component comes from barreled wine that is excess capacity coming in from Chile, Australia, and New Zealand.
Yeah.
So that's flown in as agricultural produce.
Not let it be boated in.
It could be boated in. Probably boated in. And we should say brought in, and that'll cover everything. It's then blended with local wines and bottled and sold on the shelves as local wines. So the spin-off from that has been a very, very good one, which is people are acclimatizing to that style of wine, that taste of wine. And I do believe that when the import shutters come down and this wine market monolith suddenly starts consuming like you can't believe, it's already going to be disposed towards the tastes of New Zealand, Chile, and Australia predominantly, so which bodes very well for the producers in those areas. So this is a good thing, really good thing.
Your business going forward, where do you see it going? You've obviously got a fairly strong foothold in Hong Kong. Do you see yourself going into places like Shanghai or other Chinese markets, or is maybe going into Indonesia an option?
No, it's a great question. The company has already opened up in Beijing and Shanghai, so we already have sellers there. But these are again for consumption wines. Pretty much what the philosophy was with the company when I opened it only in Hong Kong back in 2003-2004. But for wine collections as a wine center of Asia, this is the only place. And Hong Kong will just continue to grow as the UK did for 400 years. You know, I'm sure every 10 years everybody said, well, can we keep it up for another 10? Yeah, it's going to happen. There are going to be four wine centers in the world. It's going to be UK, it's going to be Paris, France, it's going to be New York and Hong Kong. And those four legs of the table will hold the table up, I believe, for the next 100 years. Will some ebb and flow? Yes, I think UK especially is in for a hard time because France is making every effort possible to take over parts of your organization and what you hold dear. And I think they're going to be very successful in the short term. Overall, in 20, 30, 40 years' time, you know, will the status quo level out? Yeah, I think, you know, there's still be four legs to the table. But insofar as Asia, there is only Hong Kong. We have the expertise. We've been doing it for 40 years. We hold one in five bottles of rare and fine wines that exist in the world under our ownership. It's only a matter of time before they end up in Hong Kong. We will be the largest auction market this year. We have the best logistics. We have the only fine wine storage certification system in the world. We have organizations like anti-counterfeiting that nobody else in the world has, where we have police, customs, merchants, traders all coming together and sharing information on how to stop this before it even starts. Many people make jokes about fake wines in Asia. Well, all the fake wines in the world currently actually started off in UK and Europe. So they're just filtering their way over to us at the moment. So we're just stopping them coming in. And most fakes that are produced in the mainland are very recent vintages. So with the advent of it starting up over here, they happen to be in the mainland and staying in the mainland and in essence being very young. It would be very illogical if somebody was exporting wines from the mainland to Hong Kong. Again, it's illogical, a taxation flow. If you have 50% tax plus the quarantine problems there, why would you bring it into Hong Kong? Mm-hmm. So, of course, Hong Kong customs has a brick wall against anything flowing in the opposite direction. Likewise, wines coming in from Indonesia, Thailand, and India into Hong Kong just wouldn't be allowed. Certainly, they'd be inspected very, very thoroughly because it's an illogical movement. But wines coming in from the UK and from Europe, they flow in pretty smoothly. So here we just need to make double sure that the fakes that do exist in those areas don't make their way across to us. So Overall, it's a very healthy situation at the moment. It's a situation that I think will continue to grow. We're very strongly supported by government in Hong Kong. And they have their heads on very screwed on very, very well at the moment. They know exactly where they'd like to go. I believe it's with the blessing of the central government from mainland. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen so smoothly. So, yeah, I think it's now just walking up a stepladder. It's not going to be all free sailing and easy movement. But as long as we keep on walking up that ladder, we'll get to the top. And I think we'll probably be number one in the next 5 or 10 years overall.
That's very bullish. One last question. Your Crown Wine Centre here that we're in, and you've got a members bar club area. Do you have to store your wines here to be a member?
Yes, actually the reverse. You have to be a member in order to be able to store your wines here.
Oh, okay.
So basically it's a grade one historical building recognized by UNESCO as a heritage site. As a result, the upkeep is pretty severe. On a financial basis. So what we do is we use positive taxation. We have a membership club, which you have to pay monthly dues to join, or rather a joining fee to join and then monthly fees to maintain. We use those monthly fees not for profits, but rather to maintain the site in pristine condition. And we say those people who can afford it, it's positive taxation in order to save the historical site. And then they earn the privilege of keeping their wines in this place that we regard as the best wine cellaring in the world.
Okay. Excellent then, Greg. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Chris. Good to speak to you.